Welcome, everybody, to another Double Toasted interview. It's been a while since I've been able to interview anyone. Corona probably has a lot to do with that, but sometimes it's worth the wait. We have a very special guest here today, and I heard you guys talking about her earlier when we even just the mere mention of her name, and people like, oh my God, you're talking to her? She's too good for you. What did you do to get her on the show? So, people, I don't know what I did. I got to thank our production assistant for getting us together, too. But I'm very honored to have over here Lindsay Ellis. Lindsay, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you. Your audience flatters me. I think I am just the right amount of good.
No, you're not amount of good. You're an amount of great for them. Greatness. They could care less about me or what I have to say. They're here to see you and talk to you. And later we might even get some questions from you guys in the chat to ask Lindsay right here if we have enough time. But Lindsay, I will introduce her and what she does properly in a little bit. I also want to let everybody know that Horchata is here. Christian Torres, how you doing, man?
I'm well. This is a big moment for me, as I already gushed earlier, and so I'm going to put my professional cap on now, and I'm just really excited to be here. Thank you for including me, Coleman.
Yeah, no. Thank you for being here. You know, you, Lindsay, I'm going to say that he is a huge fan of yours, and he probably knows way more about you than I do, so I thought it'd be a good idea to have him on. But to let people know about you just very quickly, because we're going to be talking about these things in a little while. But Lindsay has just released a book, and she's also huge YouTube star, has articles written about her film essays, her movie knowledge. She's also, if you can look at the room behind her, you could probably guess that she's a huge geek.
See my wall of star screams.
Yeah. We're definitely going to talk about her. I confused it with love. She said that might be a strong word, but
I think Transformers fan is correct. I think people, you know, but that doesn't mean you can't be critical of the thing that you are in the fandom of. Cause I think that for the most part, the Michael Bay movies are, you know, usable, but you know, fascinating. So that's my approach to the Transformers fandom.
We'll talk about certain things you have fandom for. Transformers, certain categories of movies, musicals being one of them. Mm-hmm. But you know, I want to talk about some of your accomplishments right here. I was telling everybody even before we started today, for anybody who knows Lindsay, then I don't need to tell you this, but as a proper host, I will put it out there for the few that don't. Her YouTube page, approaching 1 million pretty soon. You haven't even had this up that long. I'm looking at it right now. You have 984,000 subscribers right there.
we're having a 984,000 sub stream in a couple hours. But yeah, I think like the joke I like to say is like we're like roughly the 20,000th most subscribed channel on YouTube. So, you know, moving on up.
Very nice. Very, you know, so that's what I want to talk about with your success for your YouTube channel. You know, it's for anyone who has gone to your channel and knows your channel, I'm sure that they've seen your Hobbit duology videos. It was a series of videos, about three of them. I got a clip of it right here that I'll show people. It's your breakdown of the Hobbit films, and in the middle of them they kind of take a turn. You know, you start talking about the Hobbit, but then it turns into an industry thing too. Let's take just a real quick look at a clip of that for those who haven't seen it.
The trilogy was released between 2012 and 2014 under the subtitles An Unexpected Journey, The Desolation of Smaug, and The Battle of Five Armies. The creative team behind The Hobbit is almost uniformly the same as that from The Lord of the Rings, with one curious addition.
For better or worse, you're as known for the movie you didn't do, The Hobbit, as the ones that you did.
We'll get to that. A huge chunk of the cast returned to reprise their roles from Lord of the Rings, most notably Ian McKellen as Gandalf, Andy Serkis as Gollum, and Hugo Weaving as Elrond.
Now, that turns, it looks like it starts out as a typical video essay, but then turns into a whole thing about, if you can correct me if I'm wrong, about how the Hobbit films and maybe in Lord of the Rings kind of ravaged New Zealand in a way.
Yeah, in a way. It's still very controversial because obviously it's like James Cameron is really taking advantage of that Hobbit law, and it's called the Hobbit law. And watch the duology, and the joke is that at the end of the second video, like, oops, it's three now, which is, you know, what happened whenever they were actually released Hobbit. Basically it was a law that limited mining power in New Zealand, which made labor much cheaper there. Was very controversial and has only become more controversial, but American film companies have very much taken advantage of it, you know, for better or worse.
Yeah, you know, because of how detailed you got with this, I believe you got a Hugo Award.
No, we were nominated. We were like the second. Yeah, I can't even say I'm the first YouTuber nominated. I'm actually the second YouTuber who's been nominated for a Hugo. The first was Rachel Bloom, who went on to create Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, the CW show.
Yeah.
But I guess I could say I'm the first video essayist to be nominated for a Hugo. But we lost to AO3, the Organization for Transformative Works, the fan fiction website.
But even being a YouTuber and being nominated for a Hugo Award, being the second person, a second YouTuber nominated, that's a big accolade within itself.
Yeah, we're pioneer. I guess like YouTuber as a label definitely has a stigma, and it's not unearned. You know, I think a lot of people who have success on YouTube tend to be the type of person that will do anything for attention, you know, like the Paul brothers are kind of like the example of that. So, it's an interesting, place to be where, you know, we're, I guess, obviously catering towards an older audience by YouTube standards, like, you know, people in their 20s and 30s. And I guess challenging notions of the type of person that makes content on YouTube.
You know, it's funny because I could even probably read my notes. You took certain words right out my mouth for something that I want to ask you about later. I almost want to, like, it's like, shut up, Lindsay. I'm going to mention that later. But no, you actually said something that's very interesting that I'm going to apply to a question later. But what I want to, you know, with again, the praise that you've been giving, you know, even being nominated for a Hugo Award is almost an award itself. And the success of your channel, what is it that you think, because essays are not uncommon on YouTube, what is it about your particular essays that you think makes them so successful and stand out and make people want to award you for them? What is it, your personality? Is it a combination of how detailed you get with it? What is it that makes stands out from the rest?
In that case, it was advocacy. It's who wants to advocate for you. And basically, it all kind of started when, because like, obviously, like the people who are the Hugos are like science fiction and fantasy fans. And there was someone who was very prominent in the community who watched the videos and immediately was like, this would be considered eligible for best related work, which is the category that we were nominated in. And so she got a bunch of other people who were very active in the Worldcon community and were just like, hey, nominate this. You know, I really believe in this. So I think it's, you know, it, part of it is like, do people like your work? But part of it is also like, who believes in your work enough to actually advocate for you, which I think is kind of unusual in influencer culture, which, yes, that is what I will call it because that's what it is. Because people tend to think of, like, you know, YouTube videos almost as like commercials these days, yeah. You know, like almost like infomercials, because that's slowly what they're becoming. and, you know, again, it's not earned. And that's part of why I've stopped doing sponsored content on my channel. I do sponsored content on my podcast. But, it's only right now, it's only for one thing, and that's Nebula, which is an alternative. Ironically, it's the alternate alternative to YouTube. But yeah, I think in that case, it's like, if you make great content that people like, that's fine. But I think it doesn't occur to people that advocate for it to rise above its station, in the words of Hamilton, to, you know, be worthy of attention outside, you know, the streamies and the webbies, both of which are extremely, extremely corporate.
You know what? I'm going to pass this off to Christian to ask a question. I'm going to get into your book in a little while, but I definitely find it interesting. And you being a very popular YouTuber, you know, your take on YouTube, the platform itself, saying that you see this becoming, you might even say that's the way it is now, that it's becoming a huge infomercial. You know, everything is just a big infomercial. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more? And with that thought, where do you see the platform going in a few years, if that's the case?
I really wish it wasn't a monopoly. But I think there's this sort of weird sort of cognitive dissonance going on right now. You know, the corporate world versus, you know, making interesting art. Because I think, like, you look at TikTok, where they don't really make any money. I think that they use the form that originates on TikTok. It's almost kind of like a form of film language. More interestingly than what you're seeing on YouTube right now, which is trending more and more towards television and a much more conventional mode of like editing and framing. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but I know that YouTube is, you know, they're pushing different things. Like, on the one hand, they reward engagement, they reward watch time, and they reward like high emotionality, which is why, like, it, you know, some scary reactionary channels do really well on YouTube because, you know, they get really high engagement and they have really, really long videos. But I guess the flip side of that is, you know, YouTube is pushing for legitimacy. And what they see as legitimacy is, like, you know, celebrities like Will Smith, who is a YouTuber now. Weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, things that look like television. And so I think that is a little bit about at odds with what we used to see, which was, you know, the almost kind of vision of a different form of film language. Editing on YouTube used to be very different from what you would see in a TV show or in film, and now kind of trending more and more the same. And I think that is a result of, you know, having more and more branded sponsorships. Like, they will only tolerate so much.
Yeah.
Experimenting.
Yeah. Do you think that, and again, this is something to, I think it's interesting to ask, being that you are such a big, as you say, influencer and officially a YouTuber.
I'm not that big. I'm what they would consider mid-level. Okay. Like, because since I'm like, you know, less than a million subs still, that's sort of like mid, you know, like B and C list. I think once we pass a million subs, which, you know, hopefully we will in a month or so, then it's just like, it's sort of be like, yeah, we did it.
Well,
mid big leagues, boys.
Okay. Well, then you will at some point. Let's just say it's safe to pass that. You know, you have a lot of stake in YouTube then. So do you see, you know, with what you're saying right now, do you see YouTube being more limiting as time goes by? And even right now, do you feel like you're limited by what you can do on YouTube?
Yes, absolutely. Because you have to play to the algorithm, like the kind of stuff that you put out. Like, if I put out something short, it had better be clickbait, because or it had better be like for a good reason, because lower engagement means like your next video will be promoted less by YouTube's algorithm. And so the result is that we kind of sometimes shelve things that are more interesting to us in order to focus on something that we know is going to get more clicks. Like, you know, the last video I did about Disney live action remakes, you know, I'm not going to say it was cynical, but like it was sort of like we did it because like, oh, we need to like boost our algorithm rating because the last one didn't do very well. And, you know, And so the result is that you do tend to limit yourself because you are so concerned with staying on that. And like, you know, YouTube Studio, if you look at it, they have more and more overt that that's what they want you to do. Like, when you log in, there will be like this big banner that's like, oh, this video's not doing as well as your last few.
Yeah,
maybe you want to. Yeah. And that does no matter how much you don't want it to, it absolutely embeds itself into like the type of content you, because like we did one on Phantom of the Opera earlier this year that we worked really, really hard on. And it was, you know, it's like on the one hand, it was a thing that interested us a lot, but you know, it's kind of a struggle to like allow our to do that and say like, you know, it's okay to do a topic that you know isn't going to get a lot of views. So absolutely, you know, you know, because if you want to stay in YouTube's good graces, you have to play to their algorithm. It's just, and this is a business just as much as it is like making people are interested in and want to see.
Yeah, that is true. Christian, you want to add to this? You got anything you want to ask?
Yeah, I mean, because I think that that's something that we all kind of struggle with when we're in this business is the idea of it's commerce, but does that mitigate or spur creativity? So, you know, I'm always interested in that as well, because it's like sometimes you have to make concessions, but overwhelmingly, do you feel like you get to do exactly what you want to do 90% of the time?
In a way, I'm in charge of basically everything that I have anything to do with. I think the only thing where I'm not like the top dog is PBS. But even then, I basically get like the final say on like the writing, even though I have several co-writers. So it's kind of like yes and no. I can't even begin to imagine what the channel would look like if I was just like, wait, whatever, you know, just like pure id. Like we've spent so much time like cultivating a brand, cultivating a voice, like, you know, building an editing style that is like unique, but familiar. And you know, we have a lot of fun with it. Like, I think it's gotten to the point where writing isn't the fun part anymore. Editing is, because so many of the jokes are done in the editing, and like that is like incredibly gratuitous, and people really like that stuff. Like whenever we'll like, you know, hone in on something, and like I think one of the more popular ones is a line from The Hunchback of Notre Dame that's from the Jason Alexander gargoyle. It's like this very serious moment in the movie where they're watching Paris burn and they're like, oh, it's hopeless. And then it cuts to Jason Alexander playing poker with a pigeon. And he's like, you're telling me I'm losing to a bird. And it just like just destroys the pathos of the scene. And we thought it was so funny. So when we did our like hour long video on Hunchback, I kept splicing that in just because I thought it was funny. And people just like got obsessed with it. So
yeah.
People really respond to that sort of like, I do think it's authentic because it's like, we think it's funny, so we're going to put it in. But it is also sort of like, you know, choosing what you know that people are going to respond to, because there's some in jokes that, you know, are just going to fly.
Yeah.
So I think like, yeah, I think 90% of the time you do get to choose it. And since I am sort of the arbiter of, you know, what goes, it what stays. It is kind of a weird place to be, because I often wish I had like a boss that would be like, you know, here's your 9 to 5 and then you can turn off and then you can go build a puzzle.
Yeah.
I don't really have that.
Yeah. I don't think anybody who works online, not just YouTube, online in the kind of space that we do ever has that. That's yeah.
You're always like, ooh, what can I monetize next?
Yeah. 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 It really is. I don't know how it is for your marriage.
I mean, weirdly, it's like my spouse got laid off in the Great Plaguing, along with every single other engineer contractor at the place where he worked, which I won't name because they might hire him back whenever they, you know, get the money for it. But like lately it's been fine because he's like, yeah. He wants to be supportive, but like in general, it is honestly kind of difficult because like he does do the 9 to 5 thing and he can turn off when he gets home. So it's like, even if he had a stressful day, he can just kind of decompress and be like, I'm away from the office. I'm, you know, like I can go to, you know, lie down and go to sleep. And meanwhile, I'm just always kind of on. And I think that's hard to empathize with when you don't live it.
Yeah. Yeah. Nah. Yeah. my wife's just hit. She's I think I'm ready to go in any day, and she's gonna have an intervention for me because she has said, like, you seriously are, it's not even funny anymore. You're a workaholic. You know, you have a problem. You know, so
Yeah.
I'm glad to know I'm not the only one.
Yeah. It's kind of like that thing with YouTube's, like when you log into YouTube Studio and they're like, you're getting fewer views this month. Like, it's not just like the platforms that we use, like Twitch and YouTube, they drive that. Like, they push you to be like that. And I think it's healthy, and I wish it wasn't like that.
Yeah, no, I do too. I wish I could take a break. But that, you know, that brings up, you know, speaking of how busy you are and how you say you're always on, let's switch to your book over here, Axiom's End, which I think just got released 2 days ago.
Yes, it was the official release date was on Tuesday, although like every bookstore was just like, whatever, we got it in. And because, you know, apparently, like, if there's no hard like embargo, like bookstores will just put it on the shelf as soon as they get it.
Yeah, you know, so we're talking about always being on. You always are thinking about going in and curating these channels. You have to maintain these channels. And then you go off and you do things like you have other things besides your own channel. Are the other things that you're maintaining? I'm looking at the PBS show that the PBS digital show that you have is lit. This is the channel right here. You can see a lot of videos that they have up there. But you know, between keeping your channel up, editing your channel, going in and writing for your stuff, and then you also host this, you know, someone else's show, and then you have a book out. And I'm like, God damn, how did you write a book? You know, you do a lot of things that people can't even be successful in one area. And somehow you manage to stay busy and you're successful in all these areas. How do you find time to juggle all that and then write a book?
You know, it's funny that you say that because I feel like I always feel like I'm never optimizing my time, and I could have done so much more and I should be doing so much more. And I think that is, I wonder if previous generations allowed themselves to take a break because they didn't have these, like, frickin', you know, YouTube Studio being like, you're slipping in the views, hon. maybe you want to do a little more. In the case of It's Lit, I have a co-host, she does roughly half the episode. Sometimes we'll share, sometimes we cameo. And it used to be a lot more fun back when we used to, you know, be able to film in the studio in Austin where you guys are. So I hope that one day we get to do that again. But for that, I have co-writers. We have a consultant that does all the research for us. So that one is much more of a collaborative effort. So in that way, and also we don't do any of the post-production, like, which is very important because that stuff takes forever. So that's a much more collaborative effort. So that in its way is easier. So whenever one of us feels really passionate about a subject, they can just head it up. And that will be roughly like the one It's Lit episode you do every 2 or 3 months. But the book is like, you know, it's just like, I think people can see, like, if you see there are gaps in my, output, that's probably because I was working on a book. Like, the real draft of Axiom's End that, was eventually the one that went on submission. I did the bulk of the work right after those Hobbit videos went out.
Yeah.
So that was like, you know, the biggest project we have ever done, like, to this day. And I hope it's, you know, I hope one day we get to travel. Cause like, I know people, like, Brazilians in my Twitter mentions are always like, come to Brazil, because that's like the Brazilian stereotype. But the truth is we were going to go to Brazil this year to do like a similar big project, plague. But like, it was right after I finished the Hobbit series was where I did the bulk of the work. Because, you know, part of it is just like, whenever you finish a project, you still kind of, those wheels are going, you know what I mean? Like, the energy is still there, but the project is done. So I kind of would push it into another project. So when you see gaps in my channel, that's probably why. Because the second book is, on draft two. So, and that one, my final deadline is in February. So expect some gaps. Okay. I think August will probably be a gap month. I think it's just about like knowing your limits. Like, I actually just turned down a pretty big opportunity because I had already committed both like to the PBS show, and I have to keep my own channel going, and I have to finish the second draft of the second book, which is much longer and much more ambitious than the first book. So yeah. That one has to like hit right. It deals with much more sense subjects.
Well, you know, that's, I want to ask you two questions about your book. Mm-hmm. One, knowing that you are so much of a movie lover, I look at the cover of your book, mm-hmm. and I look at the design, the graphic design, mm-hmm. there, and people have probably already asked you this, and stop me if they have.
Actually, no, I haven't had any questions about the design, okay. but I think I know where you're going.
Where am I going with this?
Alfred Hitchcock.
Yes, Saul Bass.
Saul Bass, yep.
You know, some Alfred Hitchcock designs, mm-hmm. also did The Shining and everything. Yeah, you know, yeah. So was that, since you mentioned that and you knew what I was going to say.
Oh, yeah. And we had a Saul Bass mood board on Pinterest because, like, I was very lucky because normally happens for debut authors is they give you the cover and they're like, this is it, and maybe they'll tweak it a tiny bit, but the first round covers they sent, I were nothing like this, and I was absolutely not. They did an entire second round, and somehow it was even further from what we wanted. And so me and co-writer Angelina, who does all of, she's my co-editor, and she basically does half of everything on my main channel and also co-writes It's Lit, we like sat down, and she was the one who did Saul Bass. She one that, like, I think Saul Bass is the aesthetic we want to go for. And so we created this mood board, sent it to them, and it was like this whole process. I hired like an outside graphic designer, but like eventually it was all done in house with very, very heavy input from us. That was very deliberate, and we fought hard for that cover too. the final version was the 26th draft.
Nice. You know,
which is insane.
Yeah, I'm glad that you recognized what I was going to ask you, because yeah.
I'm glad you caught it, because you're actually the first person to catch the style by name.
Well, you know what? I'm glad, because I said, you know what? This is going to be a stupid question to ask.
That was like a whole thing. Like, we pushed hard for this aesthetic, but that started, like, I guess it kind of goes to show, like, sometimes your instincts are correct, and pushing for the thing that you know aligns with your vision is the thing you should do, even if it may not seem like the obvious thing. To the people you are pitching it to.
It's a great cover. It's a great cover. And it's definitely eye-catching enough to want to know what the, put it back up there so people can see. It's a great cover, and it's eye-catching enough to make people want to know what this is about. I could tell people it's about, but I have you here, and I think you'd probably be the best one to sell your book. Can you tell people what this is about? I can do it too. Christian, you want to try? Christian's
yeah, like, why didn't Christian do it?
Christian, you try.
You want me to do it? Oh yeah, God, but I'm only four chapters in. What I like about it is that it's a kind of what's the divergent point of our history? It takes place like in kind of an alternate history, 2007, where there's been a first contact by aliens. I'm only four chapters in, but that's what it seems like.
The main protagonist of the story is this lady named Cora,
whose father is the actual whistleblower of this whole leak to begin with, and she's kind of intrinsically linked into the big conspiracy. People are following her around, and I don't want to say anything else other than that, because that's as far as I've gotten to. It seems to be like kind of in the same vein as I think you once said that you were very influenced by Orson Scott Card for all the good reasons, none of the bad reasons.
I just wanted
to know if that kind of still held true when you were writing this. Did you take any specific influences from anybody?
Oh, tons. Like, I think if you were to name a, like, especially film, like, I think, like, people have correctly observed that it, you know, it feels very cinematic. And, you know, it definitely is. It's, if you name, like, an alien narrative from the 90s or 2000s as an influence, you're probably correct. Like, I think I have direct references to like every single one of those in there somewhere, except for Invader Zim, which is my mistake. And I wish I had done. But yeah, it's, you know, it's, I guess the thing is like, it starts as a conspiracy narrative. I think the actual plot and where it ends up going tends to, I wouldn't say surprise people, but it may not seem obvious from the outset, but hopefully ends up being a satisfying read. I think it's much more character driven than people expect to be. And I guess more feelingsy, because I think I try to bury the lead because I want an adult audience, and I want people to like maybe kind of realize that they're into something that they don't realize that they're into. And I guess, you know, in the weeks to come, we shall see how successful that is.
I wanted to come in and first of all, say congratulations on the reception of the novel.
You know,
people who are looking for the novel, you know, if you're out there finding it or trying to find it on the internet, like Lindsay, I told you, my wife, I mentioned this to her and I mentioned the premise of the novel, just the premise of it. And she was like, I like that. I'm going to look this up. And she came back and she told me she ordered the book. She can't wait to read it. She's into it. I mean, I'm not saying this to be nice. Like, I almost got a little jealous, you know, because she was gushing over you.
I hope she likes it. I guess, like, it's funny because, like, before it came out, I was, like, freaking out. And I, you know, was kind of doing this, like, you know, only child, like, you know, gifted program thing where I'm like, oh God, if it's not perfect, everyone's gonna hate me. But like, now that it's out and, you know, seeing that, like, even if everybody doesn't like it, there are some people that it means a lot to, and like that actually it made them happy and made them, you know, a little bit distracted from the plague year. You know, it's a lot easier to deal with now, and you know, it's nice to know that you know, even if it's not everybody's bag, there's a lot of people out there that are appreciating it, and like that is good enough for me.
Well, I tell you, it's been getting a good reception here. There's been some great reviews out there. That's one of the things that pushed my wife to want to get it. You know, she found an article telling about the book. Mm-hmm. Also praising the book. So congratulations on that. I have to, now this is where I want to ask you, because you said something earlier and I said, God damn it, Lindsay, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to use those words. You actually used the exact same almost phrases that I used, because I was going to ask in regards to your book, I was going to ask you, being a YouTuber, there is a certain stigma that comes with being a YouTuber. You know, you use the specific examples like the Paul brothers. But, you know, I usually say the stigma that comes with it is obnoxious youth, people pranking, being loud. And if you're successful, you probably have too much money too early, too fast. And, you know, just a lot of immaturity that goes with it. You are the exact opposite of that, of course. You've written a book, you're married, you know, you're productive. You seem like a good person, so you don't fuck with people.
I try. So, mistakes were made, but, you know.
But, you know, I'm sure we all have made them, but you having, again, this stigma of a YouTuber, did that have any impact on publishers wanting to take your book on?
I do wonder, because I don't know. Because there were two editors, because the way going on submission works is if you're going through traditional publishing, so you get a literary agent, they sign you, and then they may or may not do a round of revisions. We did one round of revisions, and then we went on submission. And two of the editors I talked to, which usually a round of submission will be between like 10 and 15 publishing houses. Sometimes it'll be like to put out feelers, like see what the demand is. And sometimes it will, you know, depending on how big the agent expects the demand to be, you know, you'll go, you know, you'll put your A game first. And I think that's what he did. Because we put it on submission on Monday, and the first call we got was that Friday. Mm-hmm. And the editor that we talked to was like so excited. And he, the way he talked about it was like, yeah, I'm not going to have any problems getting the publisher on board. We're going to talk to you on Monday, and we're going to make an offer. And then Monday rolled around and the publisher was not on board. This happened twice where you with the editor was like, just seemed so like, I got this, you know, I just got to get my guys on board and, you know, got to get our ducks in a row and then we'll make an offer. And then they dropped out. And I, you know, obviously I will never know why, like it might have been, you know, we already have a book like this on our list, or maybe like the publisher didn't agree that like it was very good. But it could also just be like, influencers have a bad track record and like the stigma is there, you know, maybe they looked me up and they saw something they didn't like, you know, you never know exactly why people, you know, accept you or reject you. Cause the guy that eventually did buy it, like the first thing he talked about was the PBS show and how like cool he thought that was. One of the jokes like that we have, like a lot of my colleagues who are YouTubers is like, well, what do you say when people ask what you do for a living? And if complete strangers, I usually default to either I'm a writer or I work for PBS. And when we were publishing the book and they did like the first, like the hit copy, and they were like, from YouTuber, boop, boop, boop. And I like had to send like this blast to everyone at the publisher. I was like, do not use the word YouTuber. Do not strike it from your vocabulary. Like it is a bad word and it is going to work against you. And and I think because a lot of it is like, you know, there's this stereotype of the YouTuber book. And I think that is most YouTubers. They just knock out a book for easy cash because it's like a product and, you know, people can, you can get assigned and, you know, they don't really care. I think it's honestly pretty rare, you know, for effort to go into one of these things. Sorry, I thought I heard a whiny dog.
Killer in the house?
No, I thought I heard a whiny dog, but I think I, yeah. It's like, it's not time for walkies yet. But yeah, no, the stigma is real, and it's definitely something we've had to be careful about, because it's like where you want to appeal to my audience who knows who I am, but if you don't know who I am, you have to be extremely coy about it and be like, I work for PBS, and I have a Hugo nomination for, you know, things.
I hear you. Christian, you got anything you want to add here?
I'm really interested in the idea. I think you certainly have to be creative to do academic writing, but I don't think it's the same thing as creative writing. And you've shown how really like adept you are at doing the academic writing. Was there a big schism when trying to write creatively for the novel itself, or did you kind of lean on your academic research ability? The one example I have, and I did not fact check this, so if I'm wrong, I'm sorry, which is that I think it's the second chapter right before we meet Cora. There's a very, very short chapter where you're just talking about the fluctuations in the stock market on a specific day. And for some reason, I was like, oh, was that like a jumping off part? Did she just go and research something and used a truth to kind of tell a fiction? I just wanted to know if you can kind of talk about the distinction between academic writing and creative writing.
It's honestly really hard because part of it is you have to know your shit, but you also have to accept that you can never be completely knowledgeable about something that is completely outside of your purview. Like, I think one of the things that I'm, I guess, most niggly about, like self-conscious about, is like the CIA, because that's really hard to research. And also there are a lot of locations in the book that you literally cannot go to. Like there's a fair chunk takes place at the Cheyenne Mountain Complex, which is where NORAD is based. You can't get in there. They used to give tours, but after 9/11, no mas. But on the other hand, sometimes you choose to just omit reality because it's fiction, you know, like you're allowed to change things or like not be completely realistic because, you know, the plot needs it. And also it's aliens, guys. It's but in the case of that, like the stock market thing, I think what I did was I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure what I did was I started with what the actual stock market was on the day that the book begins, mm-hmm. and then almost kind of used that as the divergent point for like the alternate history. Right. And that's why the stock market kind of changes in a way that is more reflective of what happened a year later, because that's sort of a, I guess one of the set dressing-y like background noise aspects of the book is, you know, sort of we in the, you know, real world know that this stock market crash was inevitable, but because of the sort of like upheaval that happens in the book, it happens about a year earlier than it would have happened. So like we knew it was inevitable, but the people in this universe don't know it was inevitable. They can be like, aha, well, the government did it or the aliens did it, and kind of incorrectly assign blame to, you know, something that we know was really going to happen. And so that was, you know, it's sort of like a back and forth. I honestly think it is different because, like, on the one hand, you do have to do a lot of research, especially for setting. But on the other hand, you know, you're allowed to be wrong in fiction. You're not allowed to be wrong in, like, academic writing. And so that does take a lot more effort to, like, make sure, like, your facts are straight and, like, any kind of, you know, alternative viewpoint is vetted and possibly included, because people will get mad if you don't. And so, you know, it is really different because you can choose to ignore reality with creative writing.
Yeah.
It's kind of part of the benefit.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to move it on to something a little lighthearted here, maybe. You know, I want to get around to the geek side of the girl over here with all those Transformers behind you, because everybody's looking at your bookshelf right now, and you know they're getting shelf envy of what you have behind you. So, yeah, a lot of people noticed they were Transformers back there, and you know you're from what I understand. I mean, I don't know if it's the Michael Bay movies or the property itself, but you're a big Transformers fan.
Oh, there they go.
See, it got you wearing your styling with your shades and your Transformers shirt on right there. Even right now.
No, this is Dark Universe. This is, you remember Dark Universe? The Universal was going to have their own cinematic universe.
Oh, I'm not talking about the shirt you have on right now. That's the thing. You can't see the other shirts. I got that. You're actually posing like you're a Star Wars model. You know, you're up against the wall and stuff. You got on the Star Wars shirt. You got your glasses. You're looking up in the sky.
Oh, yeah. I see the wired piece.
I know what Dark Universe is. Yeah. Believe me.
It's like, I know Dark Universe. Do not Dark Universe explain to me.
Yeah. Hey, don't talk. Don't you talk down to me.
That is the wall of Starscreams. If I could lift up my computer and take you into the other room, we have like a walk-in closet. That's my husband has about 800 Transformers from across the generations. Not G1. He's not a fan of G1, but like really, like these are mine. I have a couple more over here that you also can't see, but this is just Starscream.
Yeah.
And then that we have some of my Tolkien stuff, some of my Lord, like,
well,
yeah, this is the Lord of the Rings shelf.
You know, I have there was a quote here. Instead of reading the quote, I'll actually let the moment speak for itself. But there, you know, you had a quote saying that Transformers, especially in the movies, there was one particular time that had a great influence on your life.
Oh, yeah.
Bumblebee, stop lubricating the Mac.
Get that thing to stop.
You know, you're older now.
Yeah.
You're
and it's like you said that, I'm like, yep.
Yeah, you're older now. You're actually an academic at this point. You've written a book. You ever look back on those moments, especially these Transformers movies, and like, yeah, that was stupid?
No. I completely stand by that. Like, I think because that was I don't know. I think like the John, like again, 2007, that moment in the first Transformers movie was sort of where, I guess, I don't know, the brand was born, because I was like, I already had a degree in cinema studies by that point. I had graduated college. You know, obviously NYU is one of the like premier institutions for the study of the cinema. And we had definitely done a lot of pop culture stuff at NYU. It's not as pretentious as it sounds, but like I hadn't really thought of how to apply it. And then this, you know, scene in the Transformers movie was just like so fascinating to me that it kind of made me like obsessed with the study of Michael Bay and like almost like Michael Bay as an auteur. And that's where the idea for the whole plate came like a few years later. Granted, me and a colleague, his name is Dan Olson. He does Folding Ideas on YouTube. So if you like my stuff, you'll probably like his stuff. But he and I started kind of writing these essays that were like, we're going to talk about the Transformers franchise, but like very, very seriously and very, very like like we're going to give it its due diligence, because that's not a thing you see terribly often, especially for Michael Bay. And it is honestly kind of wild to me that there isn't more academic study of Michael Bay, because he is so influential. I just, there was just something about Bumblebee Stop Lubricating the Man that just spoke to my soul. And I don't know, that's just my, like, my brand ever since. Like, they, you know, asked me to, like, that, someone did a cartoon of that moment, and that was my Twitter avatar for years, was John Turturro getting peed on by a robot. And I only recently and begrudgingly changed it. I will probably change it back after this whole book tour is done. But, like, yeah, it's just, I think that to me, you know, it is sort of what eventually became sort of the brand of the channel. It was just like this juxtaposition of low art that is like base and kind of invites you not to think about it with like high concept and academia. And so, you know, it's, you know, okay, Michael Bay, you're, because the other thing about Michael Bay is he's very well educated. Like, he went to Wesleyan. One of my professors was his classmate. He knows what he's doing. So I'm like, okay, Michael Bay.
I never had any doubt that he did know what he was doing.
Yeah, he knows. He gets it.
You know, I have one more thing, because Christian, you can add on to this, but I have one more thing I want to ask you. If you want to get back into kind of academics, this is just curious to me, because I have very strong feelings about something that you addressed in one of your videos. By the way, people, they're mentioning, we love your whole plate videos.
You know,
I'll tell you, you have some big fans up in here.
Oh, thank you. The whole plate, yeah. I think the most common response to the book is there is a whole plate reference in the book about halfway through, and like half of my Twitter timeline is just like, ah, see what you did there.
Yeah, no, a lot of people even saying I can't wait for the next plate. So, Moon Metaphysics, we rock with you, Lindsay. So,
I find it really funny that her divergent point is a few months after the original Transformers movie. It's like 2007.
Yeah. Yeah, man, you know what?
Yeah, just something about that year, I don't know, just broke my brain. And then I was just like, okay, this is where we live now. This is my brand.
There's a video essay that you did, or a video that you did about J.K. Rowling. Of course, J.K. Rowling is in a lot of controversy right now for her comments about transgender and the use of transgender woman. You know, that term, people, you probably heard of it. If you haven't, go look it up. It's all over the place now. But you did on your channel, you did a commentary on this about its death of the author. And you know, basically it's about, I believe, you know, again, if I'm oversimplifying this, please let me know. But I think it's about separating the art from the artist, you know, that old argument. I'll let just a snippet of this play real quick.
Basically, you can try to be rational about the whole thing and be like, don't support her financially. But the reality is, it's a lot more complicated than that. So while on some level there is a sort of broader political discussion on how she wields her influence, really when people want to talk about death of the author in this instance, they want to reconcile their personal feelings about Harry Potter with the author. Like, how do I reconcile the fact that the author of this series is using her power to do such incredible harm, all while genuinely believing that she is doing the right thing, with the fact that the series was so formative for so many people?
Now, keeping in mind that you even use the term yourself, influencer.
How do you reconcile this?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to put that back on right there. You use the term yourself, influencer, and you also, now you've also written a book, so you probably understand, you know, you're closer to this issue than a lot of people with, you know, at least understanding what it's like to be a writer and putting something out there that a lot of people react to, either positively or negatively. But, you know, being that you are in that position, you probably have a very interesting answer on what it is like to separate the art from the artist. Christian and I talked about this the other day, and I have some very strong opinions on separating the art from the artist. What are your opinions on that? Whether you're taking from that video or your own feelings, you know, what are you thinking now?
Well, the point I was trying to make with that is I think J.K. Rowling is such an outlier that it's kind of she's a world of its own whenever we're talking about separating art from the artist. You know, that said, and this was something I said early in the video, like I've seen people using death of the author for as an excuse to continue to ethically assume her. And my point was that death of the author is an academic theory that is, you know, was conceived only for the study of a body of work. Because before that, it was very common for, you know, we are going to study this text in the context of the author's life, and we're going to incorporate their biography. And so this French dude named Roland Barthes came along and came up with the concept of death of the author, basically trying to say that, like, sort of as a contrast to auteur theory, and saying that, like, the text should exist independently from the author's life and the author's worldview. So effectively, I kept getting a lot of questions on Twitter that were like, how does death of the author apply in this circumstance? And I'm like, it doesn't. It absolutely doesn't. Like, you're trying to use an academic theory to justify your consumption habits. And that's not why death of the author exists. That's not the point. The point is for study. And what you're asking is just like a completely different question. You're asking how to like continue ethically consuming her work. And my point was there, like, you know, I don't care what you do with your time. Like, you do whatever, but like, if it is genuinely your goal not to support her because you disagree with what she said, you can't consume Harry Potter anymore because she has so carefully and inextricably tied herself to that franchise. She has such insane control over it. So even if you're doing something like writing fan fiction, you're still kind of promoting her brand, and her brand is where her power comes from. So I think, like, personally, I'm like, it's not immoral to assume it. Like, that wasn't my point at all. And I think, honestly, it's kind of an irrelevant question about separating art from the artist, because in this case, it's not really about like how you interpret a word. It's about, are you signal boosting this person, and where do they get their power from? And like, my point there was like, if you really don't want to support her, you can't say the fans own Harry Potter now. Like, no, categorically they do not. Like, you know, I think that's a very naive and selfish way to approach it.
Yeah.
Like, we all participate in unethical systems every day. You're not a bad person. And that was like, 'cause like a Carl of Swindon, like raided my channel a couple weeks ago. After that video came out, which is like the dumbest, worst faith, and you know, like, they don't listen, they don't care.
Yeah,
they're just looking.
Yeah, no, that's the internet. Period.
Yeah,
I agree with you. I thought that was interesting, and I really want to hear it from you, because I agree so much. It's like, maybe you can separate the artist if that artist is not creating new works. You know, I see people use H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah, people kept bringing up Lovecraft.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Lovecraft, and I'm just like, Lovecraft is dead, and, like, it's kind of impossible to enter a discourse about Lovecraft without talking about like how racist he was. Like, that's a part of discourse. And I don't think it's dangerous or unethical to like be in the Lovecraft fandom, because if you're in the Lovecraft fandom, you're not a fan of the guy or what he believed. You're a fan of his weird shit. And a lot of, I mean, granted, there are a lot of racist Lovecraft fans, but for the most part, like in the mainstream, people are, you know, very good about these discussions and, you know, what it means to consume the work of someone who was so, you know, hardline and weird. Like, even then, like the whole, like, by the standards of his time argument does not hold up at all. Like, to me, that is absolutely yeah. nonsense.
But at least he's gone and, you know, his works yeah. are found again. If you consume the work, you're not exactly empowering him anymore. You're not contributing to his bank put or his bank account or his influence, because he's gone. Right. You know, if you have a person that's out there and you know what that person's like, and they're still putting out things and you're still buying that shit, then you are actively supporting that person, knowing good and well what they are. So you're right. Yeah. There's a level of selfishness, I think, that goes on with that. I just want to hear, you know, being a writer, where that came from. Christian, you got anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, well, I mean, just from a personal thing, now that you have a novel out, so it's taking away the cancellation part of Death of the Author, which shouldn't apply to begin with. Do you hope for reader response, or do you really believe that, like, especially because it's an ongoing series, is it about what your authorial intent is?
You know, again, because like a lot of the point I made in the J.K. Rowling video and the point I made in my original Death of the Author video is I think that Death of the Author is an interesting concept in, you know, kind of the way that like Keynesian economics is an interesting concept. Like it's in pure theory, it makes sense. Like supply side economics makes sense in theory. But in practice, there's always these like real world, like, you know, a multitude of real world complications that make the theory flawed. And that's why you can't ever predict like where the stock market's going to go. So I feel like Death of the Author, again, is like interesting in theory, but in practice, it's just not like, you know, biases are going to creep into your reading. And if you know anything about the author, that is going to creep into your reading of the text. Now, that said, as an author, I would like to die. Like, I'm just, it's, you know, fly free little bird. Like, I, you know, if people ask me questions, I'm happy to answer them. But like, I don't want to be like Wizard Poops with J.K. Rowling. I don't want to like do ex post facto, like, well, this is, you know, this is what I meant. Or like these aliens are gay. They're so gay. Yeah, I just didn't
after
mention
the fact,
it.
Yeah.
Like, I know,
yeah, it wasn't in the text,
I would like I want people to kind of like have their own interpretations. And I kind of feel like if people are interpreting it in a way that is wildly outside of what I intended, then that's kind of on me. You know, that means I wasn't clear enough. I'm like very like, kill me. I think it's like once it's out, it's in, you know, other people's hands. And I feel like if people don't want to support me because they, you know, disagree with my politics, that's totally fair. You know, I do that all the time. Like,
yeah.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, because I do have influence, nothing on the level of J.K. Rowling, but like, I do occasionally use my influence to advocate for things I believe in. And if you're like, you know, if you hate trans people,
I'm with you. Like, I don't support Kanye. I wasn't a big Harry Potter fan to begin with. I love Harry Potter, the movies, but I can't support anything. I don't even know if I want to see this new movie, you know, these Fantastic Beast movies anymore.
Oh, yeah. God, they're so bad, though. Like, I think that was just like,
so that's not very hard, you know?
Yeah, I know. I'm just like, are you really sad? Because are you really torn over the Fantastic Beast? Are you really?
I wanted an excuse not to watch them anyway. So,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I'm getting
just
them. You know what, Lindsay? I know it's 6 o'clock. You got some more streaming to do, or you got some stuff to do later. I just want to say that people, it's funny, you know, these platforms are huge. YouTube is huge. Twitch is huge, but it's still a small world. I just want to bring to mind that, you know, I've always had 6 degrees or less separation between myself and Lindsay. I see you're a fan of history buffs. Nick Hodges' channel. Yeah. You know, we
yeah.
A good friend.
He too needs to upload more.
Yes.
He's like worse than I am with his like once every 6 months, like bring back history buffs.
Maybe he's writing a book. Who knows? You know,
I don't know. Yeah, you know what? Sure. I can't wait for his alternate history. I'm sure his alternate history will be like, you know, in the 1560s.
Yeah. But no,
if he wrote a book, I'd read the shit out of it.
yeah. No, he's a great guy. Real good friend of mine. He used to come to town and stay at my house sometimes. And, you know, I used to go visit him and yeah, man, over in London. That's a great guy. And Andre Meadows, you know, Andre Meadows, black nerd, man.
Black nerd comedy.
Yeah. Saw him not too long ago in, when I went to LA. So,
it was back before the plague year.
Yep. Pre-plague. That's how we're going to start referring to things. Pre-plague. My wife pre-plague. Even said, are you just a little disappointed that you weren't able to put like a pandemic in your book after you saw Corona come up?
Me?
Yeah. Like,
oh,
you
no.
Could you talk about?
Like, I will never do that because I think there is definitely like, you know, A, plenty of people are going to be doing that, but B, you know, I think we need to. There needs to be room to fictionally live outside of the thing we are living right now. So it's like, you know, this series will have like different world crises,
gotcha.
But not like this one. Not doing
a little too close to home right now. No,
I'm like, I live it. I don't need to read it in my aliens blowing up things fiction.
Yeah, man. You got to tell you, with how close things are, it was only a matter of time before I got my way around to you, Lindsay, and it's been great. So thank you. Christian, you have any last words here before we go, sir?
Nothing other than to say that I've really liked what I've read, and it's been a real pleasure and honor to do this. And I'm going to be praising the book from the mountaintops. So thanks again.
Yeah.
I hope you like the way it ends. And thank you guys for having me. It was a lot of fun and your questions are really interesting. And I can't see the chat, but I'm sure you guys are great too. thank you guys for watching.
Yeah. Thank you. We're going to let this girl go. Hopefully when you come back to Austin, you can come hang out. Come on to the show.
Yes.
It'd be great to meet you in person. Like I've met some of these other people. You've been incredible to talk to. Congratulations on everything. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. Yes. We will hang and we will collab as the kids say out there.
As the youths say.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to let you go.
Over.
Thank you so much, Lindsay. And we'll talk to you later.
All right. Thank you. Have a good one.
Bye-bye. And there she goes. Damn. I'm trying to get rid of it and it won't leave. Like Zoom. I'm trying to get rid of you. You won't go anywhere. Leave meeting. There we go.
You got
to
end that meeting, Bubby.
There we go. There it is. She's gone. There she goes. Christian, thank you, man.
Yeah, no, man. I wish that technically we would have had that a little bit better because I would love to have helped out better. But no, that was great. That was like an amazing kind of experience. And I feel bad we didn't ask more about her book, but she was cool.
I felt like we asked a lot about the book, and that's why, because I want to get on to some other things before she left, because I know our time is limited, as most people are, man. And I really wish that, I'm sorry that we, you know, couldn't work it out to where I could have it to where you could come in more randomly, man, because I know the audio is a little bit weird, but you asked some great questions.
Yeah, I mean, if we ever get a chance to do it again, that'd be cool. I mean, in the world. But no, it's fine, man. And honestly, like I said, this is such a weird thing because since we've been doing this, I met with the Real Rejects and I met Andre. And like, you're doing things. You're opening doors for me, son. So I just want to say thank you again. And that was awesome. No, real talk. Like, that's a big deal. That's a really big deal for me. This is one of my favorite content providers on all of YouTube, and to get to say I did something with her is really, really amazing, man. So thank you so much.
Yeah, man. And chat, I wish I could have had you guys on. I'm sorry. You know, it's weird with these interviews because sometimes a person will, let me pull up the chat real quick here. I don't have you guys up, but chat, you got to be careful with these interviews because sometimes you'll get a person who has a lot to say, which is a great thing, and you don't want to interrupt them and you want to be respectful of their time and you want to get the questions that you have in also. So, sorry that you guys couldn't taste no peanuts this time. Yeah. That's in reference to our David Keith interview where he was up there eating peanuts like he was throwing dice the whole time, but
it was work.
It was work. But yeah, man, chat, I wish you could have had you guys on. You just got to be careful how you do that. And it's always a time issue. But hopefully we can manage that a little better.
Now that she's not here, I can talk that shit. All right. Like, if I didn't like that book, I would say that. And it's really good. Like, I've read the first four chapters of it. And I really like it, man. I think you'll like it, too. Was Mia bought the copy, you said?
Yeah. Yeah. She said she was going to buy it. I don't know. I was leaving the house and she was really into it. So I told her to check because we have library cards, and I told her to check and see if she could download it from the library. And then maybe she can get a digital book. She likes reading. She's a fucking hipster. She likes reading actual books. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Being literate, such a hipster mentality. Yeah. Fuck you, Coleman.
If it's not on my phone, if it's not on my phone, I'm burning it, throwing it into a fire. So yeah, man.
They make iBooks, man. You can read Axiom Zen on your.
That's
on
what
your
I'm
phone.
Talking about. I'm reading that. If it's not digital, then I don't want it. You know, if you give me a hard copy of a book, I'm setting that shit on fire. So yeah, man. It was good, man. Ryan, isn't it? Bitch, I own physical books too. I'm sorry. Sorry, I didn't mean to offend all the physical book owners out there. All right, guys. Thank you so much for being here, chat. And thank you so much for looking at the interview. You guys, I saw some great comments in there. I really did, and I wish I could have put them out there. But again, she was a great guest because she has a lot to say, and I'd rather have that than somebody sitting up there saying nothing. So thank you, guys. Christian, thank you, man, as always.
Thank you. No, dude, seriously. Big, big, big thank you. I'll see everyone on Monday.
Yeah, see everybody on the next one. And folks, as usual, I've said this once today. I'm going to say it again. You can reach us anytime. kcoolmans@gmail.com. That's kcoolmanz@gmail.com. You email us with any kind of questions, comments, compliments, insults, input, and our advice. Hit us up on the social medias right there, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Copy that information down, memorize it, use it, love it. And if I'm too busy out there loving your emails and your words, I may need some help. Christian Torres.
Yeah, you can find me over on Instagram at Christian.monster, Facebook Christian Leon Torres. I think we have so many new people watching, so come find me, everybody.
There you go, people. Come find him and come find us in Austin when the time is right. When that big Roni's gone, let us know what your plans are for Austin. Email us kcoolmans@gmail.com. Whether you are visiting or even moving here, let us know what you're up to, and hopefully one day safely we can continue to safely accommodate you. All right, everybody, that is it. kcoolmans@gmail.com. Hit us up sometime. Good night, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Whenever you are listening to or watching this, goodbye and stay toasted.